Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Randy Harper joins me. We're going to talk about open source software for your car, the Genevi Project. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Randy Harper. Episode 282, recorded February 5th, 2014, Genevi. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at Stonehenge.com, bringing you, as often as I can, usually weekly, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the small projects, the projects you're probably using every day, the projects you might not have heard of ever. And I love the variety of stuff I get to bring on the show, and I'm usually joined by a talented co-host. This week is no exception, Randy Harper. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's so great to be back. It's been a while.
Yeah, well, almost a year, right? Something like that, huh?
Something like that, I think, yeah.
Cool, cool. Well, it's good to have you back. Good to have you back. And in fact, the show we have today is sort of interesting because it's sort of up your area. Why don't you describe a little bit about our show today, what it's going to be about?
Our show today is actually, it's about Linux in cars. It's, from what I recall, and I've only gotten a chance to look over the notes a little bit, it's about entertainment systems in cars, I believe. Open source and free software, and it's totally up my alley because I'm really into hacking cars. I used to have a sports car, and I had netbooks hooked up, and I love getting into that kind of stuff, so I'm really excited to see what our guest has to say.
Yeah, this is the Genevi Project, if I'm pronouncing that right. I'm sure I'll correct it if I don't have it right. Also, just for those of you that are watching the video and can see a slight change in the background or are listening to the audio extremely carefully and can tell the audio isn't quite the same as it was before, I am back in Portland, back home this week. I'll be spending 1 or 2 weeks a month here in Portland to work remotely for my client down in Santa Monica. And so I'll get a little more often to use just the plain Blue Yeti, not the Blue Yeti Pro. I kind of actually can already hear the difference in it in my headphones. So hopefully you guys won't hear it out there, but that's the way it is. So I'm calling from Portland. Randy, where are we speaking to you from?
I am currently in San Jose, California. I actually drove through Portland a couple days ago, and had I known that you were there, I would have stopped by and said hi.
Yeah, well, I've only been here for a few days, and I'm going back. I'm actually leaving back tomorrow, going back down south. So, but yeah, I guess that's all there is to say about that. I was trying to figure out, this isn't this. Oh, no, I was just going to comment on the fact that I said it backwards again. I said, where are we speaking to you from? Well, I'm speaking to you from Portland. I get that question backwards so often. It's a little crazy. Well, enough about us. Let's go ahead and bring on our guest. Jeremiah Hello. Foster, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm speaking to you from Gothenburg, Sweden, the west coast of Sweden. It's sort of in the heart of Scandinavia.
Very cool. Very cool. And so we gave sort of a quick overview of what we sort of collectively figured out Genevi is, but you've got a lot more knowledge about that. Why don't you go ahead and give us the 30,000 foot view and kind of describe the problem space that it's solving?
Absolutely. You guys got it exactly right. It is about entertainment in cars, what they call in-vehicle infotainment, or IVI. And that really encompasses, say, media, music, movies, navigation, traffic information, other things like that. Stuff that comes across on the head unit, but they sort of branch out a little bit into the cluster as well, so dials and speedometer, etc. And the group that I work for Genevi, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. And that was founded by BMW, by Peugeot, Citroën, and by Intel. So it's a big alliance of car makers and what they call tier ones. And I'm the community manager. But tonight I'm going to be wearing more of a open source automotive hat and try not to speak for Genevi. The automakers have very strict policies about things like that. And some, unfortunately, one of the guys I wanted to bring on to talk from one of the auto companies was not allowed to participate in tonight's call because he's not allowed to give live interviews. Mm. And that's a company-wide policy. And that seems unfortunate because most of the software or all of the software that comes out of Genevi is open source. But those are the policies, and the automotive industry is pretty tough about that kind of thing. So I'll try and stay away from any landmines tonight.
I'm sure you represent perfectly, but you just mentioned a couple of terms that are jargon terms. I want to make sure we all understand what you're talking about. So you talked about the head unit and the cluster. Can you explain that? And I know how to where the steering wheel is. I can get in and push the gas pedal, but that's about as much as I know. And in most of the modern cars I get into, there's usually a TV screen. It might be touch sensitive, or it might be, you know, I have to run stupid dials and push buttons and stuff like that to figure out how to move everything on. Is this what you're talking about the head unit, that thing in the center?
Exactly. That's the thing in the center. It's what they call a two-din box, and a din is some kind of measurement. But of course, you know, with cars, it's so expensive to produce them. So on the production line, you have to have everything obviously just in time, and everything has to fit. So the head unit is this thing that nowadays holds this little like TV monitor. And the cluster itself is your speedometer and tachometer usually. But nowadays, those are electronic as well. They're no longer just gauges that are representing some sensor input. They can be completely rendered on a screen and more often than not now even show some navigation information.
So this is going to tie into the car's ECU, like the car's computer itself, or is it just going to be strictly entertainment?
You know, the Geneva Alliance's focus is strictly on infotainment. So that'll strictly be entertainment. But of course, there are a bunch of organizations out there like Automotive Grade Linux from the Linux Foundation, something of an initiative there. And while that's sort of maybe that has Toyota is involved with that. And so they might focus on clusters. They might go into the car computers. As you probably know, there are a bunch of ECUs, electronic control units in there, and a separate network, the CAN bus. So Linux doesn't really run, or a lot of open source software doesn't really run on those tiny microcontrollers. But nowadays, modern cars have this big honking CPU, and Linux runs really well right there, as well as other operating systems like QNX, which is sort of the incumbent, if you will. But I think that for at least for Geneva and for many of the open source alliances and companies, the target really is the CPU that does the entertainment.
So taking a step back here, you talked a little bit about some of the car manufacturers who are involved, but what about people who have, say, older cars and they want to go and try this out on their car? Is there like a home unit that they can install, or how exactly does that work?
Yeah, really good question. I kind of get this question a lot. For a while there, Intel actually created this kit, this car kit, where you could get a development board and a screen and everything and just sort of set up this automotive development environment and get hacking. But it's really expensive to put that kind of thing together because the car companies use these proprietary networks and fiber optic networks. So to get all the pieces together to emulate a real car turned out to be like $5,000 if you wanted a kit. So that turned out to be incredibly popular. Older cars don't necessarily have really big CPUs, so it's very difficult to connect to them aside from, say, getting into the CAN bus. And to do that, you're probably going to have to go through a diagnostic channel, then you need special equipment, and you may void your warranty. So it's really actually quite hard to do this, as you may have gathered. A lot of cars, maybe in the last 5-7 years, may have Bluetooth. Often you can use that connection to the car to get information off of it. The car should report some sensor information, wheel ticks, maybe GPS information if it's got it. And you can interface with that. And there's also this software called the Automotive Message Bus that's actually in Tizen that you could use to – sometimes there's an Ethernet plug or sometimes there's a USB plug, and you can use that in your car and pull off information. But there's nothing really that you can use today that would let you get at your head unit and reprogram it.
Well, what about like OBD2, for example? I mean, not all cars have that, yes. But some do.
Yes, OBD2 would be a really good way to get information off. You could graph it. You could do all kinds of stuff. And it's got a lot more information because there are a lot more sensors on the car now. The only thing is that you're probably not going to get you're only going to get read data. You're not going to get write data. So if you wanted to, say, reprogram your brakes, which is probably not a great idea, and please don't do this at home, you wouldn't be able to.
Unless you go out and you replace your ECU, which is highly dangerous, and don't do this unless you know what you're doing.
Exactly, Randy. So you know the deal, and there are people who do that. I guess they're called chippers, and people will get a chip and replace, say, the fuel mixture in their car to get a little bit more speed. but that can also create great plumes of black smoke out the back, which is kind of inconvenient. And of course, it'll void your warranty. So as Randy says, please don't try this at home.
Yeah, I just realized that I started like kind of throwing out some car terms that people here might not really know a whole lot about. And you can probably explain them better than I can. So can you give people just like a basic overview of like what, for example, OBD2 is and ECUs and all of that?
I'll try. It sounds like you might know more than I, but I think what OBD2 is onboard diagnostics. And that's a set of diagnostic messages that you can pull from your car that will give you a variety of information about what's happening in the ECUs. So if an ECU is connected to, say, the wheel tick or to the GPS, it might be able to tell you how far you've gone and help you do dead reckoning. If you have an accelerometer, it could also tell you that kind of information, how far you've gone up and down. It could probably do a bunch of things like give you information on fuel levels, tire pressure levels, anything that the sensors actually measure, you should be able to get off of this diagnostic channel.
Cool. Yeah, actually, I have a Camaro Z28 from 2003, and I got really excited when I found out there was finally a Bluetooth OBD2 reader that I could plug in. And all it tells me is the speed. It doesn't tell me anything else. It's just the absolute minimum for the design, you know. And then I plug it into my rental cars that I get when I'm traveling away from my own car, and I get all this wonderful sensor information. It's like, oh, why can't my ancient car have it? Has a plug. Why doesn't it tell it anything? So it also will tell it the fault code though, which I figure was probably worth it anyway. So anyway, back to the larger project thing. So, yeah, I had to like say, yes, I am slightly a car geek too as well. I mean,
are you?
Well, just in the sense that I love going fast in my Z28. That's probably the most important thing there at all. Nice. So back to sort of the project. So how did the project get started? How did Geneva get started? Was this being done internally originally by the various car companies? They decided to open source and come together outside the company, or is this all brand new material and we're looking for some new common platforms?
Yeah, that's a really good question, of course. I think a lot of the car companies have come to use Linux, even in a production environment, through internal research and development. That would be my guess. Now, a lot of car companies use it. I know publicly, GM has stated that they use it in their cars. Toyota has stated that they're using it in their cars. Jaguar Land Rover will have a car with it running, we believe, coming out in the near future. And there are other companies as well. So I really think that it came out internally, and then the hope was to, okay, let's see what kind of standard can there be? What kind of shared investment can the car companies make around, say, the commodity parts of it? The car companies are generally pretty good about creating alliances. They have incredible tight control of their supply chain. So I think that things like the Geneva Initiative was really based to do to drive towards standardization, a drive towards shared investment, as well as seeing how they can make Linux more of a standard in the vehicle.
So the scope of this is the is again focused on the IVI, the thing that's in the console, right? So would this be an out of the box usable? You know, flash it to this whatever this Linux machine is, and now all of a sudden you have a fully working menu, or are these building blocks that someone would then have to customize based on the various sources and outputs that the system would have?
When I look with my open source automotive hat on and I look at what the car makers are releasing, what I see are just subsystems and building blocks. Mm-hmm. You'll see them specifying Bluetooth so that you can get kind of Bluetooth audio, or they'll specify the internal network so that you get high quality audio. They're doing work on specifying fast boot times, mm-hmm. and how you can access ADAS information, driver assist information. So yeah, the open source components that are available, coming from the car companies and the others involved in this, in the various initiatives, are really building blocks. And then I think what the car companies are going to do is aggregate all that and on top put their experience, their branding, their user interface, and go to market and differentiate that way.
Okay. One thing I would hope that comes out of this is a standard look and feel for the menus. Because as a person who rents a different car every other week, I'm really annoyed at all the different ways there are just to get to the audio settings for the my IVI.
Yeah, I think you may be happy then to hear that there's even yet another alliance in town that's called the Open Automotive Alliance that's designed to make sure that Android runs on the car. So if you're used to Android, you may be able to see that in the car. Also, there's iOS in the car. So if you're an iPhone fan, you'll probably be able to use that as well.
Wow. Wow. So but yeah. that would be competitive to this, to the project we're talking about, or is it something else? Are they overlapping?
So I think that in many cases, they complement. So if we focus, if we look out there in the world of Floss and open source, a lot of the open source projects are really focusing on lower level, on top of the Linux kernel, early booting, a variety of subsystems, Bluetooth, things like that, the commodity bits that are not really that sexy to develop. But then on top of that, if you're talking about the luscious graphics on the screen, well, they may be projected directly from your phone. And both Google and Apple both have plans to be able to cast, either whether it's bundling up objects of the screen to serialize it, marshal the data to the head unit, and then it appears in the head unit, and you can either control the phone with the head unit or vice versa. That's the plan in both the Android and iOS cases. So it's interesting to see how all those pieces will fit together. I don't think that there are that many units on the road right now that have that kind of technology. Mm-hmm. But it's quite clear that a lot of people feel the way you do, that each car has a different interface, and that's very confusing.
I mean, back in the old days, there's just a CD player and a volume knob. We could pretty much find those things trivially. I mean, this is probably a great study in classic user interface issues because, when everything had the same steering wheel and the same blinker accessor and the same pull light switch, it was never a problem to go from one car to another. But now it's like, I'm tired. I've just flown in from an international flight and I'm at my home airport. But of course, I have to rent cars at my home airport for a long story I don't need to describe here. And so I'm renting a car and I'm tired and I need to figure out how to even turn on the freaking lights. And then as soon as I get out of the building, it's raining. And I go, where's the windshield wiper? Where's the windshield wiper? And they're in completely different places on all the different brands of cars that I have to drive. And it just, sorry for ranting on that for a second, but it's just, I'm hoping that out of this standard comes some sort of standardizations so that the menus start looking, a little bit better.
Absolutely. I think that's a huge issue. And I think user interface is going to be a really winning concept when it comes to cars. I mean, try pairing your phone with your car. In a lot of cases, that's really hard, especially in the demographics that buy, say, a 50,000 European sports car. Those folks are interested in RPMs and torque. They're not necessarily interested in Jelly Bean or Kit Kat. So, the car companies, I do think, have a challenge to make a lot of this technology a lot more easier to use. And as you say, a more standard interface.
Yeah, and I also have horror stories, which is why I'm never bothering to sync my phone at all with any of these things. Somebody got in a rental car and synced their phone with the car, and it erased all their contacts. So,
it's very bad.
Yeah, very, very bad. I will never do that. Not only that, I'm worried about, since I'm using rental cars, I think we get a little off topic, but hey, that's my show. I've gone into cars and seen all sorts of other people's data because they don't reset it between rentals.
Ooh.
Yeah. So,
that's just a little. Also, not really great.
A little warning for those of you out there who like the convenience of syncing or even linking your Bluetooth phone to the thing. You're leaving behind your name usually because it's like Randall Schwartz's phone or whatever. So don't do that, or unless you can also find the reset button and reset it afterwards. So be very, very careful with all that out there. So this project has some open source components. Are those primarily being worked on by people at the consortium members, like Intel and Peugeot and a few others like that, or are there a lot of becoming to be more outside contributions to this stuff?
I think it's pretty much industry folks, whether it be traditional software developers who have aligned themselves with a tier one. or whether it's the automotive car company, you know, the car companies themselves doing a lot of this work, and they do a lot of this work. The car companies are not really software manufacturers, so mm-hmm. they're having to say either reinvent themselves or acquire this kind of capability. But so far, I think we've seen mostly automotive software developers involved in the various initiatives contributing. But that is definitely changing because you can do things like download Tizen IVI, and it has a ton of automotive software, and so all kinds of people are kicking the tires, and you see all kinds of different developers slowly starting to creep in. There's a guy who maintains something called Navit, which is an open source navigation engine. And since, you know, that's one of the few completely open source nav engines around, it gets a lot of patches and updates against, you know, APIs that the actual automakers are probably going to use in the car. So it's becoming a fairly complete reference implementation of something you might find. And this is just a guy who, you know, I don't think he's ever worked for an automotive company. It was just in his interest. So, yeah, there's a real great opportunity for a lot of people to get more involved.
Yeah, I was going to say, what is the motivation then for the automotive manufacturers to not have just made this a consortium of sharing internally to people who signed NDAs versus actually having open source people outside able to contribute back to it? And it sounds like you've answered that with at least this particular application.
Yeah, and at least that application. I also think that if you're moving, say, to Linux if you're moving in that direction, you're probably going to find a lot of expertise outside of your organization. So if you're going to have to patch the kernel for new hardware, well, you might as well go upstream and let the guys who do that every day do it. I also think that is the automotive environment so substantially different from, say, a handset or a tablet? There are a lot of differences. Certainly there's regulation and there's probably safety issues that you don't really have to think about with a phone. But then there does seem to be a lot of software that can overlap. So I think the car companies, you know, when they open up, they want to bring in some innovation from those recent industries. And because the consumer electronics industry just is moving like a shooting arrow, they hope that if they sort of align with that, at least the development process anyway, they'll get some overlap and also speed up their time to market. So I think open source really helps them a lot there. It helps them reach a variety of new competencies, and it also helps them speed up some of the development process if they follow these projects as they move forward.
And a few minutes ago, you mentioned the Tizen IVI. Can you explain more about what that is?
Sure. Tizen IVI is a particular profile of Tizen, which is a complete open source operating system. It's hosted by the Linux Foundation, and it's designed to be an embedded operating system. But Tizen IVI focuses on the automotive section, and they have one for television, I believe, and for handsets. But Tizen IVI receives a lot of automotive-specific software, a software for doing, say, ODB2 communication. So you could pull down little components and start hacking on that right away and suck out all the data from your rental cars if you wanted and sell it back to the folks who rented the car before you.
Nice.
Just a business idea in case TV show doesn't work out.
But what can I actually do with this? I mean, I would I run it on some portable hardware that I would be sitting in the passenger seat beside me? Or I'm certainly not. Well, I guess if I owned a car where the data was available, I could install it into the dash or something. But is it going to connect somehow to the rest of my car somehow?
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's certainly the ultimate goal. And I do believe there are companies that are putting it in the head unit. There's a company, I believe, called Nexcom that makes these sort of silver boxes that you can buy. And I think it's really designed mostly for fleet management, for trucking, things like that. I'm not really that familiar with it, but I know that Nexcom makes these boxes. You could put Tizen IVI on that. And as long as you can connect directly to your car's network, then you can pretty much interact with the information on the network as you like. Because it's very sophisticated. It's designed to be able to communicate on the CAN bus as well as the other car networks that are in there. And usually a car has two networks, at least.
So with all of this, I'm kind of wondering, you know, what's it going to look like for users when it comes time for updates and things like that? I mean, are you going to have it pull down updates automatically? Or are they going to have to, like, you know, flash their unit? Because it seems like a lot for a non-hacker type user to do if it is, like, flashing.
Yeah, I mean, one hopes you can just sort of do an apt-get or RPM install, but I suspect that at least in the early days, a lot of the updates are probably going to be done in the dealership. Mm-hmm. Ford recently sent out an update to its Ford Sync, I believe, on SD card. I know there's a lot of talk on updates over the air, so that might be an option. Updating your car's firmware over the air might be a little bit of trepidation in that area. So, I think it remains to be seen exactly how that particular problem will be solved. But I think many of those approaches will be tried.
Okay. So how do you see like the market currently being for it? I mean, is it mostly going to be like the hacker type users who are going for it, or are you going to see more end user types actually using it?
You know, I think that having sort of this center console in the car that is a really powerful computer that shows you all your media and your music on your phone, I think that's a big selling item already today.
Oh, definitely.
I think Ford Sync has done really well. I mean, you know, I certainly don't speak with Ford. I only see sort of their marketing material, but they seem to be really heavily pushing it. And they say it really attracts the kind of buyers that they sometimes have a difficulty attracting, younger people, for example. A lot of younger people don't really, they don't need a car, or they're not as interested. There are fewer people taking a driver license. Cars are very expensive. So I think that the target demographic is pretty much everyone. That's my assumption. I mean, what do you think, Randy? Do you think that this is going to appeal to sort of power users, or will it appeal to sort of anybody with a smartphone?
Well, I'm a car nerd. I've considered replacing my ECU before. I drive really fast in sports cars. So for me, it has a certain type of appeal because I like anything that seems like it's hacking the car. And it does sort of feel like this is like that, because anytime you're hooking up to like your OBD2 or your car computer, it's not really an end user kind of thing to do, except for, you know, when you're out there and you're looking at the Prius and their computers and like the cool information you have coming at you, but that's already installed and that's already there and it's not something you have to deal with. So I could see it being more for end users if it was easy to use. And that's the big key I see, is like maintenance and just how simple it is to get it in there and keep it updated, because that's kind of a big thing for a lot of people. I'm just thinking of like my mom, for example, trying to run this. And I know she loved the idea, but maintenance is like the big thing I'm thinking of here.
No, I totally agree with you. And I think that's on the top of everyone's minds, is that this has to be easy to use. It has to be safe, and it has to be really solid. And I really do think that those are some of the goals of the automotive industry as they go forward with this. I mean, safety definitely is. I know that's a really major concern.
So what type of challenges have you had, like actually getting Linux working like this? I mean, have you had to really modify Linux all that much to get it running?
Well, the current generation of, say, ARM chips are so powerful now that Linux just runs on them really fine. So there's really very little challenge whatsoever in a lot of the hardware. And a lot of the what they call SOCs, or system on a chip, that will contain things like a digital signal processor or, a camera, video signal processing, things like that. You know, all that stuff pretty much works right out of the box. So it's really not that huge a challenge, I think.
So is this based off of like an existing Linux distro, like BusyBox, which is kind of made for embedded, or is it like all just here's the Linux kernel and build up your own distribution from scratch?
No, they definitely don't want to do that kind of thing. They want to at least sort of standardize on versions and a build system, if you will. I don't know if you're familiar with the Open Embedded or the Yocto project, but that's kind of a popular project to use for building in cars. Yocto can make the image pretty small. It strips away a lot of things like documentation that you won't necessarily need on a production engine. So I see a lot of companies going in that direction.
Very cool. Very cool. Hey, so I'm now sort of curious. I mean, you mentioned safety a couple times. We're running up against various states that are enacting all sorts of restrictions on, you know, handheld cell phone usage and stuff. And I agree with that. I mean, I'm a lot more conscious of it than I was before. I never was in the point of texting, But I would occasionally, for example, reach down to my GPS and try to change my destination or let it know there's too much traffic ahead of me and so I want to go to some other route. Happens a lot, of course, in Southern California. And I noticed how distracting that is. If we start putting more and more cool things in that wonderful, you know, head unit in the center, it sounds like we're going to be up against perhaps even legislation that says you can't even use it, the driver can't even use this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there's going to be insurance regulations around this. There's going to be a car warranty around it. There's going to be new laws about it. I think, you know, it's a big matrix of worry right now because the last thing we need in cars is more distractions. But I also think this is also a real concern of the car makers. So I think that they're going to do a lot to address it. And if we look actually at the U.S., driver error or driver distraction is about 90% the cause of the accidents is about 90% due to driver distraction. So if we can minimize that, we can save a lot of lives, actually. And I think as we move towards automation in cars, that's going to help us even more. And I think the CPU will probably play a big role there. You can do a lot more on these complex CPUs. You can do a lot more calculation. So there's like the Google car, all the other car makers have autonomous vehicles, and I think that's going to creep into the car. So I do think as we move forward, despite the fact that there's going to be more entertainment, more distraction, I also think there's going to be more automation. And I do think that hopefully it's not going to be as dangerous.
Yeah, one of the things I saw for the first time, I think, in a car I rented last year is that, I was pawing through the menus while I was just trying to get it so I could drive without some local country radio station blaring at me, which is what happened when I turned it on. and where's the button that turns that off? It's got to be here somewhere. And I often want to hook up my iPhone via the aux cable so that I can hear my turn directions on my GPS on my iPhone. And so I have to figure out where to get to the aux button. So this is why I have a lot of direct experience with how different these UIs can all be.
Absolutely.
One of the things I noticed recently is that there were a bunch of settings that were there. And then when I started driving forward, I said, oh, wait, let me switch that. And the menus all changed to something that's a real minimal set, just a few things that would make sense while you're moving. And I thought, what an innovative design. Do you see more things happening like that?
Definitely. Moving to speech interfaces. There's already studies doing cognitive load, which shows how distracted the driver is when you're talking on a phone or when you're trying to talk to the computer itself and trying to optimize what the best interface is. Maybe it's a jog dial. So I think that we will see a lot of innovations in that regard. Maybe we'll see some kind of night vision where the cameras, there's plans to be already about 20 cameras in a modern vehicle. So what kind of augmented vision will we have on a heads-up display that will be able to allow us to peer in a much broader range in front of the car into the night? That can be kind of exciting. Heads-up displays, as I mentioned, also should be very interesting, where you get, say, certain items like your speed or even navigation might be able to show up on the screen in a heads-up display. So, yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of that, things like LiDAR, all kinds of things.
Let's talk a little bit about the project again. So in terms of governance, who has the authority to accept commits? Is it just the member organizations of the Alliance, or is there now an independent board sort of overseeing the project?
Well, they've tried to be just sort of a regular open source project in Geneva, and all the software is licensed with the Mozilla license. So, it's like patches welcome, and if the maintainer feels it's a good contribution, they'll take it. So anybody can contribute a patch. There's a wiki. It's a regular media wiki. Anybody can contribute there. There's some pretty good information on how to build on particular automotive hardware. And then there's a Bugzilla tool written in Perl. Yay. That most people know how to use, so it's very straightforward.
But you said member, if it was accepted by the maintainer, are all the maintainers still employees of the Alliance?
No, that's not the case.
I wanted to hear this. So talk more about how this is selected then and how this is happening.
Well, in fact, there's a way you can propose a project on Genevi's website. They just have URLs as, you know, Genevi projects/propose. And if you had a project that you wanted to submit that you thought was relevant for a car, you could go ahead and do that and become the maintainer yourself if that was the case. And that is what happened. Now, it turned out that the project was from Ford. So, you know, why would anybody say no to that? And they went through that URL and submitted the project that they call Smart Device Link. But they're not Genevi members, and they maintain the project, and you can send patches, and yeah.
Okay, so it really has, it's not just open source in name, which sometimes alliances tend to create, so it sounds like you've got a bunch of people out there. And how about, like, overall governance? Is there, like, a one voice, one over-steering committee for Genevi?
There is. I mean, it's sort of run a traditional hierarchy. There's a Genevi board, but... you know, everything is really done in an open source project way. That is to say, technical decisions are made by technical folks and business decisions are made by business folks. There's the automotive industry has very strong process management. They may, you know, as I mentioned before, they maintain very strong control over their supply chain. So they have a very clear way of how they run projects. And it's quite disciplined and quite, in some cases, hierarchical. You might not necessarily see in, say, your typical open source project, which is sort of somewhat, you know, more chaotic. But that doesn't mean that... on the technical code side of things, that things can't be just like any other project. You know, if you have a decision that you'd like to make about a particular Genevi project going in a direction, like saying, oh, this is not thread safe, why don't you add threads in this particular model? Or we think that it would be great if we could build this against our stack. You know, there's no reason that those technical decisions couldn't be made to influence a particular project.
So then sort of begs the question, what's the funding model for this? Is this still an organization that's getting funding from the members of the alliance, or is this eventually expected to pay for itself through some other sorts of premium services of some kind?
I think with most of the consortia out there, I can't speak for all of them, but most of them will probably ask the members to contribute. So you'll contribute to, you know, into a giant pot of money, and then that money gets distributed, I believe. That's certainly the way it happens at, I think, both AGL and inside Genevi.
Okay, cool.
So joining as a member, yeah.
Sorry. Okay.
Well, you don't have to be a member to get the code. I mean, they try and make sure all the benefits of membership are available to just anyone trying to run a regular open source project. But if you want to, say, steer the project in a particular direction, then becoming a member gives you a great more opportunity to do that.
Great. Cool. Hey, we're almost out of time, so I just wanted to make sure that we've covered everything you want to cover. Is there anything that we forgot to ask about that you want to make sure our audience is aware of?
No, I think you guys asked great questions, and thanks very much.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, of course, the two final questions. I'm really hoping that one of them has exactly the right answer. What's your favorite scripting language?
I'm a big fan of Perl.
Yay! Yay! One for my column, finally, after 17 check marks on the Python side. Oh, my God.
No.
Oh, no one for Perl. Well, yeah. Another one. It could go either way on this one. Your favorite text editor?
Emacs.
Yay! All right. Well, if you ever make it to Portland, I'll buy you a beer. That's so cool. He's actually got the right answer. So those two questions.
I'll bring one of your books for you to sign.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Great. Great. Well, it's been fun having you on. I hope we've inspired some people at home about looking more into this and maybe being a contributor soon or someday. And thanks a lot for stopping by and telling us about Genevi.
Thank you very much, Randy and Randall. Thanks a lot.
Very cool. That was Jeremiah Foster, the head honcho, the open source community manager for Genevi. What do you think, Randy?
That was awesome. I love hearing about anything happening in cars, especially when it involves open source and Linux. So it was really cool show. I was actually really excited about it. It's really interesting, though, because I'm hearing more and more about car companies that are getting involved in computing. Like, for example, my computer case is actually designed by BMW. And it's such a random thing that you wouldn't really expect to see. But it's cool to hear that they're getting more involved.
Yeah, and, you know, with automation coming in, it's nice that we're actually sort of maybe moving towards a common platform, because there is a lot of wasted effort when different companies build the same base materials, when in fact all they really want to do is apply their secret sauce on top of something that's interesting. And we've seen this over and over again in all sorts of other areas of IT and computing and sciences and things like that, is that, you know, we share the common stuff and then we do our discoveries on top of that. And that's the differentiation factor. And it sounds like the automotive industry is coming around to that, too, if they're starting to all pitch in on the same base platform here.
Yeah, I, for one, am looking forward to having some sort of unified interface where I don't have to go stumbling around just figuring out how to change the channel. Just have one something that's, you know, always the same in every car.
Oh, my God. You know, and it probably not so bad for people who drive one car and actually work a few miles from their house like normal people do. But I, of course, work generally out of the state. I don't think I've actually made money in Oregon in a couple decades. So I've had to go other places to make all my money. So I spent a lot of time in rental cars. And as they all got automated, as they all got smarter, I just have this UI problem now every single time. And even renting from the same car company, they don't have the same rental company. They don't always have the same brands or even the same level of models. So I'm hoping they really tackle that. I'm also, again, concerned, as we raised in the show, concerned about safety, because if it is a confusing interface, or if it's an interface you have to step through three menus to get to something fairly common, like, pick a different radio station for this preset. It seems like we have a lot of opportunity to actually bring in cross-discipline people, bring in more people who have done UI design and especially electronic UI design, because I'm sure they figured out how to, the exact placement of a knob by now. I mean, that's probably well-known technology, but when it's like a soft knob, like where do you have to hit? And recognizing also that, and Apple figured this out, that when you press with your finger, you actually think you're pressing higher than you are. So they actually offset slightly where you're touching, sort of upward on the phone. It's really sort of weird, but I've tested it over and over again. It's very much like that. So that's the kind of thing I think, you know, eventually they'll figure this out, and especially with touch interfaces and little kids, figuring out how to keep those from being a problem. Definitely. Anything else?
Well, I think we also briefly talked about voice recognition, and I'm really hoping that gets to be a big part of this too. Because, so you know, I just did this drive from Seattle all the way down here to San Jose, and I was sending tweets, I was on Facebook all while I was driving because of the magic of Siri. Voice recognition is amazing, and we need to have more of this. It's gotten to the point to where I don't really know how to use my phone without talking into it.
Yeah. I have noticed a problem, though, at least with my Z28. Is that at higher speeds, because it's really more of a sports car. It's not a luxury car with a really low decibels in the cabin. It's actually pretty bare. And so at higher speeds, Siri is useless. It cannot hear me well enough to actually fulfill my commands. So they'll have to work that out too. Maybe they'll make the driver wear a headset or something, or have microphones that are right up next to the driver or something to kind of solve that one out. But lots of problems to solve, and it sounds like this group is one of the people that are trying to get that solved. Really appreciate it when it's like that. Okay, so we have some great projects coming up soon. We've got next week, in fact, Engine X. You guys have all been wanting that one for a long time. That is the high-performance web server. It's started out just as, if I recall, just a proxy server, and has become a full web server with embedded Perl, embedded Python, all the normal things you'd find in a large server, and can completely replace your Apache installation with something that works with a lot lower overhead, a lot more speed. We're going to talk to the people who help coordinate that next week. We've got Google's Go language coming up in a couple weeks. That's a language that's been around for a while. It's sort of a little bit C-like, a little bit Java-like, you know, kind of the usual mix of interesting languages there, but a new language for people. Works multi-threaded really well, and sort of has the same usage space, I think, that Node.js does in terms of having a high-performance threaded server-side thing. We've got Hydra, just added this to the list. That's a distributed data processing and storage system, a bit like some of the big projects like Hive, but doesn't require the use of the Heroku file system, the Hadoop. Something H file system. I can't remember what that means now. All right. Anyway, Hydra's coming on. We just added to the schedule because you guys have been missing these. I know you have. Typo3. Typo3 apparently is a fairly well-known, fairly large, not that much in the U.S., but around the world, enterprise CMS. Yes, I know you guys have all been screaming, we haven't had enough enterprise CMSs on recently. We miss those. You ate it. Second quarter will be cloud, cloud, cloud all the time again, just like we did last year. But no, enterprise CMS coming on. CoreOS after that, Linux for massive server deployments. And again, on the short list, but they still keep forgetting to email me, is GNU Health, which is top to bottom hospital solution. all the way from patient records to billing and everything else, scheduling, all that sort of stuff. The country of Jamaica is actually rewiring all their hospitals to use this from top to bottom. So it's pretty cool. We have all those names on our big magic mailing list or big magic spreadsheet, which you can find by going to the homepage, twit.tv/floss, and drilling down where it says, I think your project should be on the show. And if you have a project that is not on that list, please have the project leader email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. That's listed right there, too. So don't remember that. Don't have to write it down. Just go to twit.tv/floss. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google Plus. I make announcements there every time I add a new project or usually about an hour before the show as well to get people on the live chat. We also have Floss Weekly as a Twitter handle. We do have a live chat. We took a couple questions from there today. We usually tape at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays. We're the earliest show on the Twit Network. So you got to wake up early to be on our show or be in our live chat. You can follow me at Merlin, M-E-R-L-Y-N, at Twitter. But mostly I'm on Google Plus as Randall L. Schwartz. I post about 5 to 10 things a day there, sometimes humor, sometimes open source, sometimes still things about my health. By the way, I've now been at my goal weight for over a year. So this is not some diet that I did that bounced and bounced back. So I'm very happy about all that. Let's see. Ben Everhart invited me to speak and be interviewed by Linux Voice podcast. He says he's going to publish the episode that I was in soon. I will let you know as soon as I know. I'll be representing Floss Weekly and also speaking at the Southern California Linux Expo, Scale. We had the Scale guys on a few weeks ago talking about that, so I won't go into that any further. Go back and just listen to the show a couple weeks ago. I think that's all the plugging I'm going to do. Randy, what do you want to plug today?
Not any huge plugs, actually. I am hanging around the Bay Area right now and probably actually moving back here. But I'm looking for more open source user groups to go to, so if you have any meetups, hit me up on Twitter.
Great. Cool, cool, cool. And you also tweet as a FreeBSD girl, right? Still?
Mm-hmm. Cool I deal. Do.
Awesome stuff. All right. And once again, thank you for coming back. It's been a long time and you've gotten all the emails saying, please, we need a host for the show. And we finally had you step up. This is really cool. So thanks a lot for all that. And, and if I ever get to the Bay Area again, I will stop by and say hi.
Well, I might actually be up in Portland again soon. So we'll see. And maybe I can stop by if you're there.
So the rare times that I'm actually in Portland, maybe that will overlap. It's true. It's true. Wow. Well, it was a good show. I really liked it. I'm glad I got a chance to do it. And I'm happy to be home for at least this week. And we'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.